Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, I don't have any comments to read because I'm saving them till we get through this important chapter. Well, in our last program, we delved deeper into Lawrence's assignment at Cairo, and we specifically mentioned that he was one of the best-informed intelligence officers in Cairo. Well, today, I want to get right back into our discussion of this vitally important chapter. And please remember, if you want to understand the Middle East today, you need to understand this chapter. Now, to help me talk about this chapter, James Brandon is back with me in the studio today. Welcome back, James.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you. So we were talking a little bit last program and didn't get finished with it about the British and their diplomatic ways of dealing with the Arab issue, and that issue is, were they going to give them a nation?
Right.
And so the Arabs had no idea that there was this other secret meetings going on without them even involved in it, and very few people understood these meetings were going on. I think one of the things that the British were really good at was kind of like playing both sides of the fence at the same time.
Oh yeah, they're trying to appease to two people that they needed, well, two peoples that they needed there in the French and the Arabs. And to even use the term the Arabs is really a catch-all term for a lot of different people that they had to try and negotiate with.
Right.
I mean, they were trying to negotiate mostly with Sharif Hussein and Amir Abdullah, but there were a lot of other interests to be represented there. Right. But between the Arabs and the French, they're really trying to broker some deals there that appeased both, and there is really no way to please both of them.
No. It's like they kind of like, yeah, you could agree or disagree with me, but they kind of ignored Ibn Saud.
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah. Which actually is also pretty historically significant because he wound up sitting on one of the richest natural resources in the world.
Yeah. In case you haven't read the book, or maybe you missed it, Ibn Saud was over Mesopotamia,
right,
which is Iraq and Iran today.
And so, the name Saud, if that doesn't ring any bells, there's a country today called Saudi Arabia. Which happens to be one of the richest countries in the world.
Right. Right. So anyway, the point is, the British, again, as we said last time, the British were a little bit concerned, were the Arabs even strong enough? And so they kind of, they were brave enough to say, look, again, now this was all going in before the war even started.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabs actually did want to revolt on their own. They wanted to revolt against the Turks. They wanted their own nation. And of course, with that, they wanted Damascus. They wanted to go all the way to Syria. And, I mean, they were asking for a lot of property, which would have also ticked off the French, by the way.
Oh, yeah. This is where this whole mess really, you really start to understand how messy it is, because there's areas that the British want control of. There's areas that the French not only want control of, but feel that they have an inherent right, like stronger than the British. They feel that anybody that wants to deprive them of that is going against 1,000+ years of history.
Right.
And then you have the Arabs who just want everything.
Right. Right. Well, the thing with the French is they felt that they had spilled, I mean, a lot of blood during the Crusades, you know, and they had spent a lot of gold.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, we know that, you know, they built castles in the Middle East. And, of course, we know that our dear friend T.E. Lawrence loved those castles.
He studied them. Wrote theses about them.
You know, and so they just felt they felt a really personal obligation that, hey, they owed them money.
In France at this time, they referred to that Syrian coast and Lebanon as the France of the Middle East.
Oh yeah,
that's what they called it. That's what French opinion was of that area of the Middle East. They felt it was theirs.
And even as I was a boy, I mean, young, it was always referred to as what is the main city in Lebanon? What is
Beirut?
Beirut was the Paris,
right?
You know, of the Middle East. And so I mean, that used to be like, if you could go to Beirut,
a tourist hotspot. Oh, it was a real cultural center.
It's like going to Disneyland.
Yeah. Not so anymore.
No.
Really not a great place to go visit.
No, I remember the news reports. Yeah, I remember the news reports when that city was destroyed and how dejected the world was over it. So,
oh, yeah.
All right, we need to talk about Beirut. Let's get back into this. So anyway, but they made it clear to Emir Abdullah. Of course, he was very concerned for his father and his brother that was already under house arrest. But, you know, Abdullah requested, he wanted guns and he wanted gold.
Right.
He needed that to get going. They weren't sure he could deliver. So they actually came back and, you know, they were trying to keep him on the line and, you know, keep feeding him a little bit. So they said, look, we'll give you support, but not till the war starts.
Yep.
And so, you know, that really, started it. And of course, I think that the Arabic peoples were, you know, they said very clearly they wanted a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And Britain indicated in a very fuzzy way, well, you'll have your nation.
They promised it to them.
Yeah.
They said, and that is interesting. I don't think we'll go into that kind of detail in the program, but in the book it goes into sort of who approved, who gave final approval on that. Like, it was a very strategic move on Britain's part to say, okay, you can go tell them that we promise them a nation.
Of course, I think history tells us that everyone wants to blame Kitchener.
Right.
Earl Kitchener. But he was dead. I mean, yeah. He died.
Yeah.
You know, he was killed in that, when his ship hit the mine.
Right.
You know, he drowned, poor guy. Anyway, this is where Corder brings it out. He says, he really says that it was Kitchener that was really, you know, really promoting it. There's this quote at the top of the page that says, since Kitchener's utterances, not unlike those of the Sharif, tended to be Delphic, you know, it's like prophetic, it's hardly surprising that his message of October 30th, 1914, has been a source of controversy for the past 95 years. That and the Balfour Declaration of 1917 are among the most fiercely disputed documents in the history of British diplomacy. It is clear enough, though, that the British policy now promised the Arabs, without as yet defining who and where they were, a state carved out of the Ottoman Empire if they helped to defeat the Turks, and offered the Sharif and his family a role of special political and religious importance within such a state, as well as suggesting that he should assume spiritual leadership of all Muslims everywhere, something that was hardly in the gift of the British government. I mean, the British said, we're going to make you the caliphate.
Yeah.
And who are the British government to think they could do that?
No, but certainly won him over pretty quickly.
Oh, like, sure.
Absolutely, I'll support you if you're going to make me a caliph.
But it says that, that Kitchener was like, went after this with alacrity. He was so cheerful and ready to give them everything. And, you know, maybe it was good that he was killed.
Yeah.
You know, so, but this has been, and I think everybody needs to understand this. This has been, you know, sticking in the craw of the Arabic peoples for all this, you know, for 95 years. And, certainly, in their minds, a Jewish state was not part of the deal.
Never, yeah.
Never. And for the Arabic peoples, Jerusalem, Mecca, and Medina are the holy places.
That's what they wanted. And, but you also then had these European nations that very much felt ownership over Jerusalem as well.
Even Russia.
Even Russia.
Russia wants ownership.
I've been to the Russian quarter in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, it's strange in the Old City in particular. You step into these different pockets of that city, and each one of them is so different from each other, because you've got your Christians, you've got your pocket of Christians, you've got your pocket of Catholics, you've got your pocket of Armenians, you've got your pocket of Russians. So many big cultures and major religions feel ownership over that city.
Oh, it British felt they had responsibility to protect the Christian places. And certainly you have to believe that Rome, the Catholic Church feels like they have an obligation to keep it. Now, whether all the things that they say are really Christian or true or not.
I think there's a lot of this topic for another program, but there's plenty of evidence that they're just like, yep, this is the spot where this happened. we'll build a church here.
I've never had a chance to go to Jerusalem. I desperately want to go, and I believe that sometime that will happen. And when that does, I will be talking about it all the time. You know, So I think that's just a great lead in to this. I want to talk a little bit about this Sykes-Picot agreement. I did not understand this. We were never taught this in history in high school. You know,
I don't remember.
You know what we were taught? We were taught about Africa and anti-British colonialism. That was my history for my junior year in high school, and then my senior year our history course was on the Holy Roman Empire. So coming from a Catholic school, you can understand why that would be. So let's talk about Mark Sykes.
What a fascinating figure in history. I did not know very much about him at all before reading this book, and I understand a lot better why the Sykes-Picot agreement turned out the way that it did, because you have in Mark Sykes an incredibly well-liked and likable, charismatic. We talked about him on the previous program being kind of like a world traveler, super respected back home in Britain, just seen as the way that we look at Lawrence and say he had experience. Back then, people looked at Sykes and felt like he was really experienced and he was a trustworthy opinion. Korda describes him basically as being able to wholeheartedly throw his support behind every single priority, every single group's priorities, and claim that he's a wholehearted believer in them, even when those things are completely at odds with each other, like claiming that he fully supported the Zionist cause, and yet at the same time also claiming that he fully supported Arabs' claim to all of Jerusalem and Mecca and Medina and the Syrian coast.
Yeah.
Those things can't exist in the same universe in peace, but somehow he believed that they could.
One of the good things that Sykes did, I mean, not that he was doing bad things, but maybe in his defense, I'll say this one thing, that philosophy of you can have two different opinions in the mind at the same time and think you can work it out, that was British.
Yes.
That was kind of a British way of looking at things. And I think that's why the empire was so successful. But the other point is that, Sykes was he was a baronet. He was related to the monarchy. I mean, he was very wealthy. I think his with his baronet, he had possession of 30,000 acres.
That's a lot of land.
that's a lot of land. So he was wealthy. He was he was very, very educated. But the point is, he was no match for Pico.
No. And I think Pico probably recognized that immediately.
So, but he still took the British idea and, we want the same thing. He wanted to believe that France and England wanted the same thing, and that's not at all what they wanted.
No, and his inability to be detail-oriented and care about the nitty-gritty, whereas Pico was exactly the opposite. He relished the details. He loved the nitty-gritty and the wording. You know, you want to talk about being legalistic and the importance of the wording of clauses within a treaty. That's where Pico was able to just pull the wool over Sykes' eyes in a way.
The thing about... I know Korda does mention in it that that it was probably, and I forget exactly who he's quoting there, and I actually should have written this page down. But he just said that the PICO agreement was the greediest thing that was ever written. Yeah. It's a whole underpinning of all of it was just greed. It was French greed. It was the British greed. And who suffered?
Right. If we haven't, I guess, made that clear to anybody listening that might not be super familiar, PICO is the French negotiator. So right. Sykes is representing Britain. PICO's representing France, and they're basically coming together to try and form the official position of both governments on what's going to happen with the Middle East after the war.
Right. But the thing is they still – this was totally secret. It was just between France and Britain.
Right.
It didn't involve Russia.
The Arabs were left out. The Russians were left out.
And it didn't involve Russia. So here I did find it. This is page 276. So we brought this up just a few moments ago, that the French believed that they had rights to the Middle East. Says the French had led the way and had paid for this land in blood and gold. And were their rights to be contested now by Arab nomads and sheep herders or by the British, who had not arrived in force in this part of the world until the late 19th century? So the French said, hey, we've been dominant here for a long time. You know, we own this. But here's a quote that the court gives. It says, the Sykes-Picot Agreement is a shocking document, the product of greed at its worst, that is to say, of greed allied to suspicion and so leading to stupidity. It also stands out as a startling piece of double dealing, a breach of faith. If even so moderate a pro-Arab historian as George Antonius, writing from New York in 1938, only 3 years after Lawrence's death, can so describe the Sykes-Picot Agreement, it can scarcely be wondered that Arab historians of the period today regard it as the betrayal equaled only by the partition of Palestine and the creation of Israel in 1947 and 1948. So he was quoting this historian, George Antonius, saying that the Sykes-Picot Agreement is just a shocking document.
Oh, and yeah. So, it's up there. It's up there with the Balfour Declaration as far as anybody in the Arab world is concerned. I mean, and honestly, I mean, I think as Americans, we are going to just side more naturally with Israel, but I think it's hard to look at those documents objectively and not recognize the intentional vagueness of the language. And even with Sykes-Picot in particular, just both countries going into that agreement knowing that they were doing deals behind the backs of other countries that they were ostensibly working with. And then in the case of France, really trying to craft that document in a way that really, like George Antonius said, it was just greedy.
Yeah. And just as you said before, James, I mean, when they finally did divide up the Middle East, it was like a butcher. A sloppy butcher because... You know, they assigned areas and gave it a nation name, but they didn't have access to water. They didn't have access to other natural resources.
Yeah.
Some other areas got everything.
They took what they wanted. This is the same analogy, the sloppy butcher one from Korda, where he basically says they carved it up like a sloppy butcher, and then they gave the Arabs the bits that nobody wants to eat.
Right. They gave them nothing. And so the thing is, I'm not trying to justify terrorist acts. I'm not trying to justify, the way the Arab people, are living, and sponsoring terrorism and things like that. But you can see why those, it's like there's scars that are still open wounds.
Well,
how it was organized.
Yeah, you mentioned 95 years. That's how far we're going back. And it's easy, I think, to look at this and see the injustice of a lot of things that happened. We also know that, prophetically, that region has to explode. That's a thing that has to happen. It's the spark that ignites the, if we want to use an ordnance analogy, it's the explosion that begins the fission or whatever. I'm not a bomb expert, but that Middle East has to explode and in order to set off a domino chain of events. And
well, it's we know that prophetically we know that Jerusalem is going to be the powder keg that starts World War III.
And what better way to make a region full of tension than have 95 years of bad blood?
Right.
And really, it goes back farther than that. But basically, our whole modern era since World War I, it's been nothing but tension in that region, and it goes back to this.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's not just – it's just not those of us that believe – fully in Bible prophecy that are saying it. There are secular people that are saying this is going to ignite World War III. I mean, I was even listening, to President Trump the other day, and he was saying, of course, he's taken a lot. I'm not here to, take a political stance, but, he's taken a lot of gaff for, getting rid of the, peace pact, or well, not even peace pact, or the agreement with Iran.
The nuclear agreement.
But he said the number one threat for us, let's say, as the United States, is nuclear war. And so I mean, the nuclear proliferation is increasing rapidly. And when you look at some of the crazy people that have access to it, it is foolish to not think it can happen.
Absolutely. And when the people that have or that were worried about having that sort of devastating military might are open in their hatred of another group of people that is regionally so close within arm's reach, that has to be a cause for concern. And that tension between neighbors that defines the Middle East, and like we were talking about, it goes back centuries, but it's not been 95 years of this, of tension between neighbors. And, the way that the powers handled this is the cause for it.
Right.
I don't want to say it's the cause, but it's a cause for it. Right. I mean, there's underlying cause for tension back.
Yes, and I think, Mr. Stephen Fleury brings out pretty clearly at times, and so does his father, that there is a being called Satan the Devil that is just absolutely in the background stirring up everybody's hatred and emotions. I mean, certainly, we'd have to understand there's a demonic spirit in the mix that's really, really feeding it and really feeding these emotions.
Absolutely.
And, the Arabic peoples, I think, are more emotional. And, we know that one of the tactics that the devil uses against all of us is he stirs up wrong emotions.
Absolutely. And then as well, I mean, if you're going to talk about the origin of nations, you're talking about brothers.
You've got
Isaac and Ishmael, the two fathers of two different nations that are at war with each other.
They were at war from the time that Ishmael got booted out of the family.
Yeah.
With his mom, Hagar. And so,
And they believe that. Arabs that I have talked to, they believe that they are sons of Moses.
Yeah.
Or Abraham, sorry.
Yeah.
But
Well, they are.
Yeah, they are. they're aware of that history and they believe it.
And unfortunately, so are we.
Right.
But we don't believe it.
No.
Because we haven't been taught it.
Yeah.
And so that's really tragic. But again, readers, I can't emphasize enough, how important this chapter is. And of course, there's a lot more details in it than we can, we can talk about.
Just scratching the surface.
Right. Talk about on the radio, but it's in there. It's in that chapter. And do not miss this chapter. Well, it looks like we're out of time for this program. Next time, I'll be playing a repeat program on teen reading in honor of our Philadelphia Youth Camp. That's our summer camp, which will be taking place. This program is a special hour program, and it features some of our Imperial Academy students and them talking about the books they're reading. Then, the week after that, we'll be back in the studio to finish this chapter on Cairo, and James will be back with me. So remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of this book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please don't miss this book. You may write me any comments you have to JBL at PCOG.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.